This is an ABC podcast.
ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
The minister, myself, at that time was not involved in negotiations of price or of vendor. That is done by the department at arm's length to me.
The former Deputy Prime Minister once again spent the day defending his involvement in the so-called Watergate scandal. And a world away from politics, an eccentric European noblewoman who traipsed around North Queensland in old sugar bags has been remembered 100 years after her death.
Many people have said to us, oh, now I know why my mum goes to me. You're not going out like that, you look like Annie Bags. Yeah. That's where it's come from.
I'm Bridget Fitzgerald, and this is Australia Wide. After a long and fiery interview with the ABC's Patricia Karvalis last night, Barnaby Joyce faced the press again in Tamworth this morning. Once again, he told journalists that he's absolutely confident he didn't do anything wrong when, as the Water Minister in 2017, he oversaw the sale of water licences back from two Queensland properties at a cost of $80 million to the taxpayer. It's being reported that price was much higher than the market value, and that profits from the sale ended up in an account in the Cayman Islands. Mr. Joyce is adamant that the controversy around the water buyback story is just a Labor Party distraction.
I took advice from the department and I did not change that advice. I had confidence that what they had done had been a diligent and forensic process, and on their advice we went forward.
I'm responsible for the department's recommendation.
Because that in itself would call into question that I'd overridden it, and people would then be asking questions as to why I did.
Barnaby Joyce says he's acting on advice. He was acting on advice back in 2017 when he oversaw the department and the sale of those controversial water licences. But 3.5 years ago, when Barnaby Joyce had just been appointed as the Federal Agriculture Minister, ABC Rural asked him who had the ultimate responsibility for decisions in the water portfolio. Here's his reply.
Obviously, water resources is going to be at the cabinet table. It's incredibly important, and I'm at the cabinet table, so I'll have lead on it.
So it will be you, and not like the situation under the environment portfolio, where the minister, while having ultimate responsibility, delegated to his parliamentary secretaries.
Well, everything. There is not one thing that can go through cabinet without the cabinet minister responsible having the say. I'm actually responsible for it if it goes wrong. The responsibility resides with me. I was the shadow minister for water. I've come from a whole life being lived in the basin. I understand how the basin works. Well, I'll make it very clear. I have lead on water.
Barnaby Joyce speaking to the ABC's Anna Vito back in October 2015. Today, Barnaby Joyce was out in Tamworth for a drought forum. ABC journalist Olivia Ralph was there too, and she joins me now. Olivia, did this Watergate story come up today?
It did. Barnaby addressed the media before entering the drought forum for a few minutes, where he very calmly repeated statements he'd made to Patricia Karvalis last night. But once in the forum, the moderator informed the audience that no questions were to be asked regarding the water buyback story.
With that in mind, what questions were people asking Mr. Joyce and Mr. Littleproud, the current Agriculture Minister?
Well, water was a big issue for everyone. The water they do and don't have access to for them, their own properties. There's at least one mine still pumping on the Namoi where farmers and irrigators are banned from pumping. Also, the Coalition's drought policy, which makes no reference to the impact of climate change and how that will have an impact on drought preparedness into the future, was another topic that was brought up. So a lot of drought policy, but yeah, a lot of water-related issues.
What kind of sense did you get from the crowd who were there about their level of concern about drought and water issues?
Well, there was a lot of frustration. A lot of answers were palmed off to either the state water minister or elsewhere, and that did elicit a bit of frustration from the audience. I guess they're looking for a bit of consistency and a bit of stability going forward, and I'm not sure that they feel they have that with drought conditions worsening.
Olivia, David Littleproud, the Agriculture Minister, was there and a big part of that forum there today. He did make some comments responding to this water buyback story. What did he have to say?
Well, he addressed the media in a separate press conference earlier today, and he announced that he had asked the Auditor General to submit a review into all of the water buybacks that have taken place from 2008 to the present. And so we will anticipate to see that hopefully in the coming weeks.
Olivia Ralph, reporting from Tamworth, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And one of the reasons that this water buyback story has struck such a chord is because water is so vital to so many communities. Water means jobs in the Murray-Darling Basin. And while the unemployment rate is at a record low across New South Wales, there are fears that a lack of water is putting a strain on jobs and the economy. Kathleen Ferguson has this story.
For many living west of the Great Dividing Range, the equation is simple.
Well, water is money. Water is farming. Water is it's great for the economy.
But the issue of water is far from simple in New South Wales. It is a scarce resource in many communities, and some areas are facing a zero water allocation as a result, including in the Murray District in the state's south. Jamie Tasker owns a farm machinery business in Deniliquin. He says the situation is desperate.
The fact that the farmers have got no water, so they just simply can't grow crop, they can't do anything, that just makes it makes it difficult.
Water featured as a major state election issue. It was a topic that resulted in significant swings and in some cases losses for the Liberal and National parties. In Menindee near Broken Hill, Mavis Pumphrey has been putting off retirement for half a decade. The long-time resident hasn't been able to sell her supermarket, despite saying it runs in the black. She says potential buyers shy away from the business on account of the town's water situation, with dwindling levels in the Menindee Lakes.
I've had a few people look, and the main reason they give, and they have the perception that the town is dying because there is no water, the main reason they give is the water situation as to why they're not purchasing.
The National Party clutched 7 votes at Menindee's polling booth in last month's election. It sits within the seat of Barwon, which was lost by the National Party to the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers. Mrs. Pumphrey says water was behind the revolt.
I think it was a general rebellion against them because they haven't listened to the people in their electorate.
Back in Deniliquin, about 100 people will lose their jobs at Sunrise. The company announced the cuts late last year, blaming low water availability and high prices. Yvette Smith's job was among those slashed. She says it has created a lot of uncertainty for her family.
I must admit my reaction was heartbroken at first.
She says she's worried about the flow-on effects the decision is having on her town.
You go down the street, it's the talk in just about every shop you walk into, the ones, and you worry for them because you know that you can't afford to spend the money like you used to.
Yvette Smith and her family often take their party barge down to the Edward River, which runs through the town. She says it is ironic to see people enjoying the full and flowing waterway.
It seems very obvious that we have water, we're out on it every Saturday, and it's flowing past us, and our children are starving. You know, not starving, but do you know what I mean? That's what's going on here, guys.
Ms. Smith says many people are concerned that water isn't being managed properly and communities haven't been listened to.
We just don't matter. You know, we're too small in their big scheme of things.
Yvette Smith ending that report prepared by Kathleen Ferguson and Joanna Woodburn.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Bridget Fitzgerald. So with all this focus this week on water buybacks and the former leader of the Nationals, let's take a look at how the Nationals are performing overall in this federal election campaign. Nationals leader Michael McCormack is on the Wombat Trail. It's a National Party tradition, the campaign bus with a difference. The Nats carry a wooden carved wombat as they tour regional centres trying to win votes. And although it doesn't attract as much attention as the campaigning by the Prime Minister or the Leader of the Opposition, the Wombat Trail team will be working hard to hold on to some key regional marginal seats. National Rural Affairs reporter Lucy Barber has been analysing the Nationals' game plan, and she joined me earlier.
They've got 16 lower house seats they're trying to hold on to. The tricky ones for the Nats are really in two in central Queensland, Flynn and Capricornia, but also in northern Queensland, there's Dawson. Now, there's also a couple in New South Wales, but really in the north of that state, Cowper and Page, that the Nats are focusing their energies on too. The one they're most worried about, though, Bridget, is Cowper. Now, that was held by Luke Hartziker, who held it and was challenged last time by the former independent Rob Oakeshott, a name that many of our listeners will be familiar with because he was a kingmaker in the Gillard minority government. He's trying to make a crack to return to politics again. And so he's the main challenger this time for the Nats in Cowper. However, he'll be challenging not Luke Hartziker, who's retiring, but a new Nationals candidate. And I think that's the trouble for the Nats in this seat. Rob Oakeshott, last time when he ran for it, had a 26% primary, which is relatively good. And when you are challenging someone who is a relatively unknown name, the new Nationals candidate, that's a problem for the party, and they don't have a strong history of transitioning seats. So those two northern New South Wales seats and those ones in Queensland will be the ones to watch.
And what are the particular issues that are going to be very important to the Nationals for particularly those Queensland seats?
I think the Adani coal mine is a vote winner or a vote loser for both the Coalition and for Labor. The candidates for the Nationals in those seats have been buoyed by the Coalition's recent approval of the late stage of the Adani Carmichael mine. Labor's stance on it is not quite as clear-cut, so that might work against the Labor candidates there. So that's a huge issue there. And it's a huge issue around the country, but it will actually dictate votes in those electorates. The Nationals candidates feel that given the Coalition's thrown its support behind the mine, it's going to up their chances of holding those seats, but they're really marginal. We're talking Flynn and Capricornia are 1% below, so they're extremely marginal. And if you think about it in terms of an overall national swing against the Coalition, if that's what we see, well, that could wipe those candidates out or those members out altogether. We'll just have to see what happens. The other issue working against George Christensen in Dawson is the fact that he has spent a lot of time outside of his own electorate. The Herald Sun broke a story recently about how he'd spent almost 300 days in the Philippines when over a period of 4 years. One of the key things in these rural and regional seats is to be seen and to be known locally. And a lot of these regional and rural seats during elections, they're won and lost on local issues. So that local grassroots campaigning is really, really important. So whether that'll work against George Christensen, the Nationals member in Dawson, is yet to be seen. We'll have to watch that one closely. But in some of the other bigger national seats, that's the reason these incumbents have to spend so much time on their road, because a lot of the Nats seats are so huge. They've got to get around and be known. And we saw recently in the New South Wales state election how there was quite a protest vote where the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party won two of the seats from the Nats. However, interestingly, Shooters, Fishers and Farmers are only running one candidate in the federal election, and that could be because they don't have a lot of money to support campaigns, but also to get around these much, much larger electorates on a federal level is physically a lot harder. So I think, yeah, for these Nats candidates to hold on and to try and save their seats or increase their margins, it'll really depend on name recognition and that sort of thing. The other big issue, Bridget, is water. We're obviously hearing about that a lot in the news at the moment, but just generally the politicking over the Murray-Darling Basin is huge, and the fact it is such a political football has left a lot of irrigators angry. A lot of rural communities feel hard done by the Murray-Darling Basin plan, so that will play into it as well. And, of course, things like cost of living, energy, electricity prices, all of that is huge out in these rural and regional electorates.
Lucy Barber speaking to me earlier from Bright in northeastern Victoria. Steve? Sticking with politics for another moment, opposition leader Bill Shorten promised today that the government's Northern Australia infrastructure facility would be repurposed under a Labor government. Mr. Shorten says the $5 billion loan lending facility is a failure because it's only spent $15 million in 5 years.
The Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund has been an abject failure. It is incredible that not 1 cent of a $5 billion Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund promised by the Liberals 6 years ago, not 1 cent has been spent in Queensland. Perhaps even more significantly, the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund has probably spent more money on salaries for people who work for the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund than it has on building infrastructure in Northern Australia.
Bill Shorten speaking to the media earlier today. Well, Steve Abson is the CEO of the Infrastructure Association of Queensland. That's a group that represents the private sector in the development and operation of big projects. I spoke with him earlier about the merits of overhauling the so-called NAIF.
NAIF is really there to encourage and enhance the prospects of a private sector project succeeding, but is not there to originate or identify these projects. So it's a bit hard to bash NAIF around and say that it's not doing its job when all it does is field private sector projects coming forward. I fail to see how tweaking this concessional loan facility anymore could really stimulate more private sector projects to come forward. The reality is if projects have a compelling benefit-cost ratio, then they don't need NAIF concessional finance. They are fully financed and funded by the private sector in their own right. So by its very nature, this facility is there to try and get marginal projects bankable, and hence that's why you don't see a procession leading to Laurie Walker's door and asking for finance. It's not NAIF's job to find these projects or originate these projects, and I think that's a key distinction that perhaps Mr. Shorten is not making.
And if we do look at what its primary purpose is, and if it appears that the private sector doesn't appear to be using that purpose as it's been made available to it, is there a better way to spend that $5 billion that's been set aside for NAIF?
Well, I think the $5 billion is there to be paid over and be paid back by the private sector. So it is a loan, and loans have to be paid back over time. It's not a grant. So it's very different to, you know, Commonwealth monies that would be put to a road or a rail project, as an example, where a grant is given to the state through a national partnership agreement. The money is spent through the capital phase of the project. This is very different. It's a loan facility that gets repaid on concessional terms over time. So it's $5 billion in an upfront slug of money towards a project or a couple of projects is very, very different to a $5 billion loan facility that can be paid over 30 years.
It is, I guess, important to distinguish the language used here. And in that grab we heard from Bill Shorten, he wants to see it rebadged to the Northern Australia Development Fund. Do you see any value in that?
I think it would be a very different arrangement to what's currently in place now. If Mr. Shorten's saying that changing the constitution of this particular facility outright and have kind of amended or replacement fund give out grants for projects, then that is a very different proposition and a very unusual proposition if it's going to start to give grants to the private sector. So I'm not entirely sure without further information and detail precisely what this particular policy announcement purports to do, but it sounds like it's something very, very different to what NAIF was actually set up to achieve, which is to get those projects away that otherwise wouldn't be getting away and wouldn't be bankable without the Commonwealth's involvement in a loan capacity.
Steve Abson, the CEO of the Infrastructure Association of Queensland, thank you so much for joining Australia Wide.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you are listening to Australia Wide with me, Bridget Fitzgerald. Annie Ferdinand's life reads like a tragic novel. She was a European noblewoman who fell in love with an English gent and followed him all the way to Ravenswood in North Queensland, where she only discovered that he was married to another woman. The shock of his betrayal was too much for Annie. She spurned all men and she took to travelling on foot, dressed in old sugar sacks, accompanied by a menagerie of animals. Now, more than a century after her death, this eccentric character is being remembered. Natalie Fernback has the story.
Annie finally tracked down her lover after years of endless walking. But when she found him, his infidelity was evident, causing her mind to become unhinged with the shock. Her love turned to a hatred and a loathing of all men, especially those with red hair.
For a woman with a very tragic life, there was still room for laughter at the memorial service for Annie Ferdinand, who most will know as Annie Bags. Annie became well known in northern Queensland for her nomadic wanderings and for her menagerie of animals.
She carried a bag over her shoulder, which most often contained a cat or two, and she always had a pack of skinny dogs following her. She earned a precarious living by fortune-telling and begging, often persuaded persons by threats of impending wrath. Also, a large part of her income was derived from selling raffle tickets for her grand piano and for a gold watch. The investors who bought raffle tickets are still waiting for the winner to be declared in these raffles.
109 years after her death, a memorial service was held for Annie Ferdinand. It was a chance for locals who had a connection to her and for people who knew of her legend to pay their respects. A crowd-funded memorial headstone was also unveiled. Historical tour operators Rod Jones and Cheryl Toms from Raven Tours spearheaded the campaign to have the headstone made for Annie.
Yeah, once we started to do research about Annie Bags, and the further we searched into all the information that was available, and Cheryl read a book about her as well, and the more we felt that we found out that she was buried in this local area, so we really felt that we should come down and pay her a visit. So that's why we wanted to find the gravesite. Yeah, we just wanted to pay respects to her, and then when we saw it was unmarked, we thought we should do something about it. And then we were going to do something on our own, but then we thought we'd love to get the community involved in this.
To remember her
and to keep her story alive, because we know that for generation after generation, this story has been passed down, and we didn't want it to die. We wanted to relive this. And
many people have said to us, oh, now I know why my mum goes to me. You're not going out like that. You look like Annie Bags.
Yeah.
That's where it's come from.
Yeah.
So it's sort of been passed on to generations, but they didn't know why their mums were saying that. They thought it was maybe a really eccentric relative or something, but it actually was probably because of Annie Ferdinand.
More than 40 people attended the memorial for Annie at the Belgian Gardens Cemetery, many with their own connections to her.
I've known about Annie Bags for a long time, but didn't know actually what she was or why I knew about it, but I used to get called Annie Bags as a kid because I dressed like a boy and had a lot of animals all around me. And then recently learned a little bit more about her at Ravenswood when we visited there last year. And my uncle, only in the last 2 days, has told me that our family has a connection with her. And I'm a descendant of the Shores from Central Bakery. And my great-grandparents used to feed her and her animals. And my great-grandmother, Grandma Shaw, she used to give her a shower when she came to the bakery, give her a shower and a fresh set of clothes. I think her story is it's tragic. It is just so sad. And I think we need to remember the people that made our history. And we need to remember our characters. Yeah, it's history.
Thanks to Natalie Fernback for that story. And that's all from the Australia Wide team this evening. Thank you so much for your company, in particular to all the Annie Bagses out there. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.